welcome to Transcending Comics, a podcast dedicated to trans representation in comic books, manga, and webtoons, both on panel and behind the scenes. I'm your host, Tommy, and I'm joined once again by my literary expert, fashion consultant, and girlfriend, Ari. Welcome back to the show, Ari.
Hey, y'all. Thank you for having me back.
Of course. Now, we're finally returning to our Invisible Community College Book Club series, where today we're going to be discussing the second collected volume of The Invisibles by Grant Morrison. Now, Ari, since our last episode together, I know you've taken in some more Grant Morrison media, some of which I've not even read yet. So tell us a bit about what you've been reading and your thoughts so far.
Have I?
Yeah, Wonder Woman Earth 1.
Okay, cool. Sorry about that. So far, I've read Wonder Woman Earth 1, the first two parts of that. I haven't finished it yet. I haven't gotten to the third part, but I really liked it. It's a lot. I get why people wouldn't like it. I can see why people would think it was problematic. Again, same thing with his other stuff, as he's just generally edgy. But the thing I liked about Wonder Woman Earth 1 is that it is really true to the source material. Love it or hate it, it pays a lot of homage to the William Marston stuff, which is out there. You know, he's got all the bondage stuff. He's got the strong women, and it's just weird, you know. And another thing I really like about it is what he did with Dr. Psycho. I'm still very kind of new to a lot of comic stuff, and so I'm used to the Dr. Psycho on Harley Quinn. So the fact that they made Dr. Psycho kind of like an actual doctor and psychiatrist who just like thinks he can fuck with Wonder Woman's head. It's really fun, you know? And that's what I really liked about it. It's just really trashy and fun. And I think that's the origins of Wonder Woman. And there's plenty of other Wonder Woman, you know, girl power, awesome feminist message stuff out there you can read. But if you want some good old Marston trashiness, then Earth One is really good.
Yeah, it was kind of fun because right as you were reading that, Grant was posting about their experience writing Wonder Woman Earth 1 on their Substack. Mm-hmm. And even they say it's like the most controversial or like most hated work that they've written. But I know that they do a really good job of like taking any of the major superheroes and putting like their entire history, even the weird parts, into their stories. Like with Batman, they were able to take like the Adam West weird 70s stuff and make that canon in a way that worked. Or like take something as ridiculous as Batmite, the little like kazoo looking tiny imaginary Batman, and make him like an endearing character and like kind of explore what that's like to be a character from like the fifth dimension. And with Wonder Woman, that included going back to like the weird character origins that people have largely left behind. But even they admit in their writing, they're like, yeah, it's probably for the best that the like incontinuity stuff is going a different direction. But like, they asked me to write Wonder Woman, and of course it's going to be weird. It's Grant Morrison.
And yeah, give me Kanga and I'm happy. But I will say, as I was reading it, I just was constantly like, oh, wow.
And you've also been with me as we've been watching Brave New World, which they worked on as a show writer, along with a few other people. And for me, it's been a good exercise in expanding my like literary knowledge, because before going into the show, I wanted to read Brave New World. And I've also been wanting to learn a little bit more about Aldous Huxley, so this is kind of helping me research both Grant Morrison and him at the same time. And I've got to say, I'm really liking the Brave New World series. Like, it does a really good job making the book a lot less problematic and also interesting. And, like, pretty much every woman character in it is much better in the show. So, like, they take a lot of liberties, but, yeah, no one would watch a show that's accurate to that book, so it's fine.
And in contrast to Wonder Woman Earth 1 that we were just talking about, Brave New World does one of the best taking something that's problematic, which is the Savage Lands in Brave New World, and really, like, not just like sanitizing it and kind of like Disneyfying, you know, doing what Disney does and just censoring it or, you know, sanitizing it or whatever, but really taking it and turning it into something that is really applicable to now. And I really like that. I really like what they did with the Savage Lands and turning it into a theme park of like, oh, this is what people used to be like. I thought that was brilliant writing.
Yeah, I forgot. It's not just the women that are better. They really did good job taking the racist undertones out of Brave New World. So good job, Grant and the other writers.
Yes, good job, y'all. Like, very, very much needed. King Kong needs to, maybe they should start writing for King Kong because they still haven't figured it out. I don't even know if you can.
But getting more into the subject at hand here, this being a trans comic book podcast, I'd be remiss if we didn't at least touch on some of the themes of gender that are played not just in the comic, but in the writing of the book itself. Grant Morrison is pretty well known as a writer that's challenged the borders of gender or challenged the limits of gender throughout their career. They've introduced a lot of characters that cross gender norms, even going back before the Invisibles and their Doom Patrol run and through other works of theirs. And Grant was labeled as non-binary by a news piece a few years ago, and we touched upon this in our last episode, but Grant's never championed that label themselves, and they've said as much in interviews and their own Substack blog posts that they don't necessarily accept that label and that they use any pronoun, though that they and them is probably what fits best. They don't begrudge the use of he or she because they say they've been called a lot worse. That said, I have a lot of people, even including trans creators, that still come at me sometimes of like, actually, Grant's non-binary, and they use they, them pronouns. I'm like, okay, don't transplain to me here. One, I'm the trans comic book person. This is my domain. Two, I'm a former Grant. Like, I'm going to keep a close eye on these things when there's actual news around a famous Grant that loves comics.
I would just merely say if talking to another trans person or anyone really, and you think they get someone's pronouns wrong, I think the correct way to go about that is to just be like, oh, really? I thought they used blah, 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 rather than calling someone out. You always have to assume you might be wrong as well. You know, just check, you know, like everyone comes from this place of ultimate knowledge, and none of us are sure of anything, honestly.
So I wanted to take an excerpt from one of their essays from their Substack. This is part two of Me, Myself, and They. That'll be very abbreviated, but indulge us for a moment as we do kind of a selected reading to expand on their own musings about their own gender and pronouns. So Grant begins with, "As long-suffering readers have heard me repeat to exhaustion, I tend to reject all simplifying nouns as inadequate to the task of summing up a lifetime. What delivers results in your teens and 20s fails spectacularly on a ventilator in your 50s. When faced with the contradictory, self-justifying, self-rewriting nature of a human life persisting through many decades, no pigeonhole can hope to be oddly shaped enough, and the older you get, the more transparently useless any label becomes." Grant goes on to mention how the 80s and more so the 90s was when they were most actively playing with their gender expression, going out some nights as a masculine buzz cut punk and others going out dressed in PVC mistress corsets with frock coat and bunker boots, etc. Grant continues, "As mentioned previously, the terms genderqueer and non-binary did not exist in my heyday. They slowly made their way into the conversation in the mid to late 90s, by which time, and raised to distressed categorization, I felt no need for what I saw as a consumer demographic label devised to limit and confine me in someone else's net, to reinforce the rules I was now expected to follow, or to reject in accordance with my assigned designation, and above all, to sell me targeted shit I didn't need. At the time, I was pursuing the dissolution of categories as a precursor to their alchemical occult fusion. The Invisibles records an attempt to collide fact and fiction, male and female, good and evil, into a non-dual in which all binaries are resolved into a higher symmetry." They later go on to write, "I enjoyed the freedom to shift and switch between trousers and dresses, heels and flats, boy, girl, mod, punk, mistress, submissive. I loved dressing as a skinhead in docks and bomber jackets, and assuming an air of thuggish menace just as much as I loved getting into miniskirts and thigh boots to flirt with boys. What must be stressed is that all these elements of me were and are real. There are major characters, minor ones, and guest stars, but they all have their own personal continuities. They have different interests and agendas. Some are in fundamental conflict with others. They can support, embarrass, or undermine one another, depending on the situation. They have their own goals and needs, which can be debated and then satisfied or thwarted by coalition. During the Invisibles years, when I wasn't traveling this spinning mad world of ours studying Taekwondo and Tantra or attending acting classes, I'd sit down at the dressing table and make invocations to Ganesh, my glorious elephant-headed patron god, and begin the night's wondrous work. I'd set up a bottle of pink champagne to stand in for the Grail, the cup of blood, and I'd take the first of usually two snowball pills. I would play the supremely cheesy Enigma CD, or sometimes the sublime Sheila Chandra record, Weaving My Ancestors' Voices, both of which lasted exactly as long as it took to do my makeup to a respectable standard and for the E to come up. In this room, which also served as my temple, I had and I still have a wardrobe where I kept all my clothes. My sister Lee covered the item in pages from The Invisibles and Flex Mentallo, then varnished it, turning the tall central mirror section into one more comic book panel where I would separate my consciousness into the image before me, turn on the strobe light to dismantle visual reality, then summon gods, angels, demons, and ultra-terrestrials with whom I'd spend the night frolicking and arguing or learning from. These rituals were conducted on a regular basis in the 90s, during which I regarded as my Burroughs Beat Hotel period. I probably spent about a third or more of every week in drag doing pyrotechnic psychedelic magic. The fabulous witch I became was as real as any other aspect of my being. One of the things I learned was that, far beyond simply possessing a male side and a female side, there were and still are lots of characters in there. My day-to-day personality is an aggregate of multiple contradictory voices existing mostly in harmony, which is where the pronoun they comes into its own. Of the available options, they and them feel closer to how the inner assembly operates than any other description. Over the decades of writing and self-examination, I managed to separate out these many, many spectrum hues that make up me, and I arranged for them to sit around a figurative table. The model of the Justice League, or X-Men, or my own Invisibles made a lot of sense and showed me how to organize the inner troop. Everyone gets a voice, but if one hogs the mic, the others convene to sort it out, gently escorting the faulty crew member from the bridge and replacing them with someone more competent. Sometimes one of us will say something the others don't agree with. We don't all agree, we see things from multiple points of view. I learned during this time that I only exist as a kind of superposition with various personality shards, shifting in and out of focus as required for the task at hand. If I find myself needing to get angry with someone, I can rotate my inner Wolverine into position. In my teens and 20s, I was terrified of public speaking after an emotionally scarring debacle at the school debating society when I was 14. Today, I have access to several gifted orators who love to extemporize and talk to audiences of any size or persuasion and in any state of sobriety. I've spoken to others who tell me they have their own inner court, a complex, a committee, a constellation. I know it's not just me. I just don't know what this is. I assume a younger generation is way ahead of me and has the terminology. Whatever it is, it's not a sickness, it's not DID, or any convenient, spurious DSM category. But it doesn't end there. Turns out, it's not what we're talking about at all. The gallery of characters I'd unearthed on my deep dives into the self were not the deepest level, not the limit. To be concluded. Now, I know that's a bit of a long side tangent there, but I felt like since this writing exists out there of Grant talking about playing with their own gender in the writing of Invisibles and literally putting on drag and having this psychedelic gender-bending ritual that they use to bring this story to life, like, this is a very valuable part of the discussion and especially how this book relates into the canon of trans comics. So I felt like I had to include this, and I just wanted to give a bit more of a platform of Grant getting to speak about their gender on their own terms, rather than having clickbait news articles determine what labels they use out of context.
Yeah, and I love that. I highly relate on that. Not quite as old, but I'll be 44 next week. So, and I definitely have listened to the Enigma album really fucking. I love what they say there. And I think that that sums them up really well from everything I know. And I'm glad to hear their journey from them.
Yeah, and I do think this is a common theme I found with the second volume of Invisibles especially, is that there are outside texts that really add to the work, and that, like, the story behind the writing of this is often just as interesting as the story itself. And we'll get into that a little bit more when we talk about the comic's contents, but for now, I think it's probably good if we give the listeners who haven't read the book a quick summary of what happens. So, this volume of The Invisibles is split into two arcs. The first focuses on Lord Fanny as the story cuts back and forth between the beginnings of her life as a woman during her initiation rituals as a witch, and the present where she's approached by a mysterious seductive man with ulterior motives. When King Mob arrives to rescue her, they both wind up captured and brutally interrogated by the Myrmidians, leading us into the volume's second arc. Entropy in the UK follows Jack as he begins to remember Old Tom's training and eventually reunites with the other Invisibles, and he agrees to help rescue King Mob. All the while, we see King Mob's psychic interrogation at the hands of Sir Miles and Miss Dwyer, and we explore the inner world of King Mob, both in his civilian identity as the writer Kirk Morrison, and the psychedelic secret agent adventures of his popular character Gideon Stargrave. The Invisibles face otherworldly horror in their rescue attempt, reality itself nearly collapses, and Jack comes face to face with one of the Lovecraftian Old Ones the Myrmidians serve, known as the Archons. Hey everyone, before we get into today's discussion, I wanted to share a quick message from our show's first ever sponsor, Succulent, the trans-inclusive sapphic comics anthology. Succulent is a lush collection of plant-themed, trans-inclusive sapphic erotic comics. The book's theme is a garden of sapphic delights. Femme flowers, sappy butches, genderqueer lesbians, trans femme wives, fleshy dykes, and thorny switches intertwine in a hothouse of lust. Search Succulent on Kickstarter from now until May 15th to back this incredible trans-inclusive book. Now, Aerie, I know this was a much more adventurous and eventful volume than the first trade of The Invisibles we read, but yes. What were your first impressions reading this?
Well, this time I actually, can we put this on pause real quick?
Yeah,
because Pop-Tart is on the bed behind me and he is snoring very loudly. I don't know if it's coming
it's
up
not
on the...
coming through.
Okay. Should I just leave him there?
Yeah, then? This is kind of adorable, so I might just let the viewer in on anytime you're hearing jangling and pitter-patter. That's our unofficial third host, our dog Pop-Tart. He's a beautiful little mutt, and he's just curled up on the bed behind Aerie, and it kind of warms my heart. But, oh, I think his ears are perking. He just...
he just heard his name, yeah.
So if you hear dog snoring, consider that our gift to you.
Mm-hmm. And he's not supposed to be on the bed, so he's getting a little treat. But to answer your question, without all the dog drama, this time around, I definitely saw the Matrix connections way more than I had before. And it was fun. You know, it was just good story, good action. And I love all the layers of it. And then Inception is very much like that, too. Mm. And I love seeing things like that. I think sometimes a lot of people want to be like, oh, they ripped that off or whatever. I see it as passing the torch and carrying inspiration on. And all three of those works are very different in their mm-hmm. own way. And I think all trying to say different things. I will say that this time around, I was kind of surprised and taken out of my element a little bit, because the first one was so me and the type of comics I really enjoy. I love, you know, what I did read when I was younger was like Love and Rockets and Preacher and Crumb and American Splendor and stuff like that. That's just kind of nothing, a big nothing burger, you know, like it's just life happening. And whereas this was very much an action story and really fun. But what I really liked about it was it just so well paid off everything that is set up in the first one. The first thing you get in this one is a Fanny backstory. And that's exactly what I wanted. So it kind of really set everything up and then gave me all the things that all, you know, answered all the questions I had from the first one, which is really nice and just gave me a really nice action-packed payoff.
Yeah, I think that was a good way to hook us in. Like, this definitely shifted the narrative more to like a proper plot than the previous ones, just like exploration of everything relating to weird occult figures, mysticism, and literature. And like the back matter of this volume even included some notes from Grant Morrison, like in initially pitching this comic, and how they wanted it to be a platform where they could tell any story they wanted. And that's very clear in volume one when like we're seeing Lord Byron and Shelley and yeah, like all these other weird elements I've never seen in another comic before. Whereas this is just like, okay, these are the characters from volume one and their story is continuing. And I'm glad, like, this is exactly what I wanted from The Invisibles. Like, this was maybe a bit more of a me volume, and we'll get into some of the weird psychedelic reasons for that later. But
To be honest, I was actually surprised you invited me back for this one, because I was like, the first one made so much sense because you have like Keats and Shelley and Arcadia and Marquis de Sade. And I was like, this is my jam. I can talk about this stuff for like ever. And when I read this one, I was like, oh, this is like a fun comic book. Oh, that's cool. But I wasn't expecting to be invited back for it because like it didn't have all my pretentious little things in it. But I'm glad I'm back.
At the very least, I know you can appreciate the first volume for what it is. Like, there's a lot of modern comic readers that I don't think would be able to get through Invisibles Volume 1 and be like, oh yeah, I want to keep reading. I mean, more advanced ones that like things like Love and Rockets or non-traditional, like, superhero comics. Yeah, Invisibles is great, but, like, we just don't see many modern comics written like this anymore, so it's hard for me to get that buy-in. And I've even had friends read the first issue, and they're like, yeah, it's interesting, but I've got my own thing. So I just wanted someone who I know can appreciate this, and who's also been taking in more Grant Morrison, both in your own interests in reading and from my various, like, watching interviews and researching their other work. So, and I think most importantly, like, just the fellow trans woman experience that can also appreciate, like, these Lord Fanny moments in the first three or four issues. And, like, I love this exploration of their character, and I was confused in the last volume when they were more referred to as a transvestite, but I'm now starting to see that here of like, this does seem like something they're presenting more in the realm of cross-dressing than them identifying as a trans woman. However, like, regardless of her presentation, everyone always does consistently use she, her pronouns for her. So things might be different if this was written now, but like, it doesn't seem like this character's on hormones or anything. They just are awesome at presenting themselves as Lord Fanny, and it seems like that's kind of their main recreational activity outside of this, is hanging out with other people that are either trans women or cross-dressers and hanging out in, like, cross-dresser bars.
Yeah, and I mean, I can tell you at that time, we did not have the language for it. And I'm not saying trans women didn't exist in the 90s, because obviously they did. Lots of trans people did. But in popular, just in people's minds, like, in the language, when you said trans woman, you were talking about someone that had fully transitioned, you know, with the surgery and everything. And as a young one, that's why I didn't even think of it, because, you know, like, I was just like, surgery is scary to me. And I don't know if I want the, you know, if I had grown up today, I would have instantly known, wow, that's me. I'm a trans woman. But in the 90s, not only were you thinking surgery when you thought trans woman, you were thinking like years and years and years of intensive therapy in order to get that surgery. And people didn't even mention hormones, even though that obviously would have been a part of it before you got the surgery. But really, people didn't even think about it. They very much sexualized it, of like, to be an actual trans woman, you had to have all the parts of a woman. Anyone else was a transvestite or a crossdresser. And that was just how we thought of it. So to a little trans lesbian such as myself, I had no idea up until a few years ago. And I was realizing that the language was changing and that I could be my true self.
And I did feel like this still got to the heart of like a lot of, if not the trans experience, at least like the moments of a trans narrative that we see, and like, there's a lot of truth in that. And like, this is what I want to see in a trans narrative. Like, I remember specifically there's that shop where Fanny's looking for like a new set of breasts, and there's a couple guys in there. Like, I don't know if it's also like a sex shop or a porn shop, mm-hmm. but one of them's like saying really transphobic stuff. And then Fanny, using her like psychic powers, just calls him out for the trans egg that he is. Like, it's a very Hearts in Atlantis moment of like, mm-hmm. I know you dress up as a girl in your free time. And like, they even call them out by name. They're like, how do they know your name?
Mm-hmm. And I think what he's going on is probably what I went on when I was younger, of Lou Reed songs, Rocky Horror, Lola by the Kinks. And then I think the first exposure I had to a trans woman that was just on hormones was, and I hate to say this, but, you know, it was the 90s, The Crying Game. I was blown away, because the one thing about that movie is it does refer to her as she, her, and she is seen as a woman for the most part, even though they get eye winky with it a lot, and have like Lyle Lovett singing Stand By Your Man at the end of it. But for a little trans girl that didn't know any better, it was mind blowing. So whenever I see Fanny, I think of that category that we had back in the day of Walk on the Wild Side by Lou Reed or Lola. Really, when I see Fanny, I see Lola. And I love Lola. Heart.
Like, I think it is surprising, since we do see that from a very young age, she was raised as a girl, like, since she was the only heir to her family and the witchcraft mm-hmm. was passed through the women of the family. And they're like, well, we only have the one kid, so you're going to be a girl. So, like, I think it's actually kind of cool then that, like, she's owning that in the present. It's not mm-hmm. like, okay, I'm now a woman because people forced me to be. It's like, oh, hey, I can be a man anytime I want. I just don't want. So, like, yeah, I think that's something I just didn't expect to see. I really didn't mm-hmm. expect to see that, like, early childhood acceptance of it.
Yeah, same.
And I would love to hear more about Grant's experience just, like, in these communities and in these spaces around that time. Because, like, right now I'm listening to one of their only novels, Luda, which is kind of a similar, like, mystical heroes narrative of sorts, but it's about drag queens and has that same, like, kind of chosen one and mentor dynamic, just without all the direct heroes narrative stuff, just that same symbology. But, clearly, this person is very well versed in it. I mean, they have their whole drag routine to get in character to write the comic. And I would just want to know, like, hey, what was it like cross-dressing in the UK in the 90s? Like, tell us more.
Right?
They do talk about it a bit in their book, Super God. But, like, that's only partially biographical and more about, like, comic book history. So we get glimpses of it. But, yeah, I would love to just see him write a biography about those years of his life for Grant in the 90s.
And not quite the UK, but you see that same mentality in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. Mm. You have these three characters and they're all kind of considered the same thing, but one of them is definitely a drag queen. Another is definitely a trans woman, because you see her taking hormones all throughout the movie and they make jokes about it. And the other is just a twinky combination of both. But they never really mention it. I don't think they ever say trans woman or anything like that, which is kind of, you know, like, it's kind of nice. It's definitely dated, but it just shows you that even that culture didn't have that language. When I was 18, it was drag queens who took me in. And now everything is so quartered off, which, you know, as a trans woman is appreciated, but I just didn't know the language for the longest time.
As far as that 90s edginess, I do love the way that they slip it into Fanny's origin of like, okay, that god of death that we saw in volume one that took care of the serial killer for them. Yeah, young Fanny befriended them with by telling a dead baby joke and making them laugh. They're like, all right, you're all right, kid. I was going to trap your soul here, but you're all right. You're free to go.
I love that whole part. And I love the idea that a queer person can impress death, can make death laugh. Because, wow, we know half the time we don't even feel alive. We don't feel ourselves. So if anyone can make death laugh, it's a young queer person that doesn't really know what's going on with themselves.
And I do like how this chapter is where we, like, once again see the comic play with time in really interesting ways. And, like, we're not just seeing things, like, narratively shift back and forth. Like, Fanny is experiencing this kind of like Dr. Manhattan, like, sees all the moments of his life at once. They're, like, seeing their initiation as a witch. They're seeing their early teenage years or later teenage years doing sex work and like getting themselves back on the road to becoming who they are now and bringing themselves back together. And then their like interactions being kind of fucked up in a bathroom and approached by a weird guy. And throughout this comic, like even later when we like see things with King Mob's past and present and like seeing later Dane's past and future, like this plays a lot with the idea of all things and all moments existing at once. So for those out there that like love everything everywhere all at once, I feel like this is a good foundational text that like kind of works towards some of those ideas. This is so much different that I'm not even going to say this pulled from Invisibles. Maybe it did, but like this just kind of plays on some of those similar ideas that like if you like this view of the universe and reality, I think Invisibles will be up your alley.
Same.
Now it's around the same moments, like, we're seeing also the search for Dane among the other Invisibles, and, like, one of the dumb little moments that I absolutely loved is, like, we turn a page, and I thought this was, like, filling in for maybe ad space that had been in the comic or something weird, but it's, like, 90s comic book art of King Mob, but it looks like Rob Liefeld art, specifically. Like, he's got the big torso, huge muscles and pouches, and then tiny little feet. I'm like, okay, this is just like a pinup. And then on the next page, we see like the small version of that in a word bubble from King Mob as he's talking to his old lady friend, getting help. And I'm like, oh, this is how King Mob sees himself. That's hilarious. And
I love it. Yeah, I love that part. And with the time thing too, he comes on to her, Edith, right? I think that's her name.
Yeah.
And he's kind of like, we've done it before, let's do it again. And she's like, oh, I was 24 then. And I'm assuming they do get it on. But that also goes with the time thing. And then you, we were talking about earlier, not on the podcast, but before we did the podcast, we were talking about how Robin mentions she was born in 1988, which means she would have been like 10 then or something. Mm-hmm. And I, again, more time play. And yeah, when you're like mysterious, ethereal secret agents, time would kind of be like that and all over the place. But they don't really, I like how they just kind of don't really touch it, you know, like a lot of things have to go hard on everything and explain everything. But when you're a world of like eight secret agents fighting like Cthulhu creatures and demons and tiny whininess, yeah, you should expect some
yeah, like they're fighting creatures outside of time. So they have to experience losing their position in time as well. And what you said there, I don't know if we touched on this last episode, but it makes me think, like, I wouldn't be surprised if the reveal is that Robin is that old lady friend of Mobbs that, like, I mean, we even see she's kind of the one that put him through psychic training. And, like, Robin's clearly the psychic of the group, and King Mob's often going to her to, like, get predictions and tarot readings and stuff. And, like, a lot of the text and pitching documents mentions, like, psychic time travelers and groups of them. And I'm like, I thought that was just the windmill scene. Like, oh, wait, no, that's Robin. And I heard in, I think it was Grant Morrison's interview with Arden Lee, that they were working on a TV adaptation for The Invisibles, I think for BBC. And it must not have come to fruition because I've heard nothing about it since. But they were actually going to make the main character of the TV show Robin, and, like, her visiting a younger version of herself, and the younger version, like, not listening to her older self, because why would you? And that's just the way of things, navigating that. And, like, if Grant ever does revisit The Invisibles, even in comic form, I would love to see that come to life, because, like, Robin's a way more likable character than Dane, and I want to know more about her. Like, she's the one that's still a huge mystery, even two volumes in now.
I would love to see that story. Maybe not on the BBC, because I cannot possibly fathom his work being translated to the BBC.
Yeah, I don't know if I want the Doctor Who sanitized version of The Invisibles. That's
exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, I don't want the Doctor Who version.
But moving on to the second story arc, like, we start to get into some of the moments of Dane's training that we didn't see before, as they're, like, coming back to him, as he's, like, being reminded of things as he's out on his own, and also as he's put in these otherworldly situations or in impossible odds, and, like, that's when the training comes back to them. Like, he has to be in a weird state of mind. One of the freakier moments for me of, and, like, this is why this one resonated with me so much more, is we see that Dane had this interaction with some kind of alien force, Barbelleth, they refer to it as. It takes the form of aliens, it takes the form of Jesus, it talks to him and is, like, what gives him the key to, like, face the Archons and tell him what to do. But, like, in reaching out and trying to get him to listen, like, they have this little speech of, like, which side are you on? The soul is not in the body is inside the soul. Do you understand? We are you. Try to remember. And for those that have heard my coming out special on Giant Size Violence, it's Morphin Time, like, that really hits hard if you've had the psychedelic ego death experience. And what's even more weird is, like, I've alluded to the weird fever dream involving Grant Morrison I had when I started this show, and I only read, like, three issues of The Invisibles, but a very key element of this, like, and it's like my brain, like, invoked Grant Morrison in much the way that King Mob invokes John Lennon in the first issue, just, you know, without the ritual or anything. But the big takeaway was the words, I am you, or, like, a magic word of, like, Iamu, just saying over and over, like, I am you, I am you, I am you, Iamu, 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 Iamu. And, like, seeing that then translated to, like, we are you, which I had not read this far, I had not been given that phrase yet, like, that's weird to me. I know it's probably just coincidence. Maybe it's pulled from other interviews of Grant Morrison I've heard, but, like, that hit weird, seeing the psychedelic trip in that moment specifically getting, like, given to Dane from beings in the ether.
Yeah, and I can back you up on that, because, like, I had the same moment. You had that moment. I was there. And then we both read it in the book afterwards, and it's like, oh, that is weird. Okay.
And so the first volume of Invisibles, I had to read a second time, mostly because I understood it a lot more after you had read it and could tell me a bit about the literary origins of it. And, like, also just it makes a lot more sense with future context. I reread this months later, like, I'd read most of this last year and just took a while for us to arrange this episode. But I still reread it months later. And I didn't get nearly as much because this one is just, like, plot, and I know every one, so there's not as much to uncover. Except, there were ideas I'd had in those months that I was then seeing had been, like, implanted in my brain in this book and were not as original of ideas as I thought they were. Like, when we were at the Zed and Zed's Dead show in mm-hmm. Minneapolis over New Year's, like, we'd been seeing these super trippy visuals, flashing lights, and just that setting always just puts me in this weird, like, concert trance state. And a lot of my best writing and creative ideas come to me when I'm in this state and just like, okay, I can't socialize. I can just take in weird visuals and inspiration and music. And seeing some pyramid stuff, like, it just came to me. I'm like, oh my God, pyramids are time machines. Like, pyramids are kind of like working time machines. They, like, give us this thing that, like, gets preserved through history and sends bits of culture and, like, memories of who a person may have been and, like, some historic context for them into the future. And if humanity progresses for another 200 or 300 years, I believe we're going to have some kind of technology that'll allow us to, like, maybe not reanimate the dead, but at least, like, clone people from DNA. And so it's following that logic, that means mummies are inevitable. And, like, we could have these beings that are, like, not just time-traveling nepotism of, like, reincarnations or, like, clones of past rulers, but also, like, they're not just going to be that. They're also going to be the product of all the culture and the legacy left behind. And, like, who knows whose DNA is actually in there? It could be anybody. And I was like, okay, this is, like, an idea I really want to explore. And then revisiting this comic, I see right in the middle in one of King Mob's travels, he's told that, like, mummies, Egyptians, burial rites, and monuments, these are the symbols and artifacts that propel ideas, concepts, and personas into the future. And they describe it as, like, a form of metamorphosis. Like, part of the reason humanity is kind of destroying its own environment is a means to, like, they call it metamorphosis. It's like a caterpillar eating the leaf it's currently living on, but then turning that into a cocoon that turns it into its next form. And, like, it being like, yeah, we're destroying our environment and seeming to sabotage ourselves, but this will be, like, our way of sending us in the future or our way to evolve. And I'm honestly pretty disappointed that my theories of inevitable mummies were implanted from this, and I now see how The Matrix and maybe other things maybe borrowed more than they realized from this comic.
Passing the torch.
Passing the torch.
Or Jungian theory, whichever one you want to call it.
Mm.
But also in that Dane section, something that kind of connects to your ego death experiences as well, and a scene that I know we both really enjoyed, is when Dane is talking to himself. Is when you see the two Danes, like one Dane comforting another Dane and one looks a little older. I think that part is just beautiful. And it really goes with the timey wimey stuff we were kind of talking about before too. And same thing with the other ones, doesn't really focus on it that much. You don't know who these Danes are, but it's a beautiful moment.
Yeah. You're referring to that thing that's like December 22nd, 2012 on like allegedly the last morning of existence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wasn't sure like if that's two versions of Dane or Dane and a friend. They do definitely look similar enough that like it could be two versions of the same guy. I had kind of hoped that maybe this was some illusion of like Dane becoming okay with his sexuality sometime in the future. Because, like, I mean, we see him projecting all this internalized homophobia elsewhere. And, like, yeah, maybe he's bisexual at least. But, like, there's so much there that, like, needs to be unpacked. Like, we even see when his confrontation with these demons is, like, bringing up his past. Like, he has this whole monologue on, like, you couldn't love your mom or your dad. Not really. You couldn't love your mates or you'd just be, poof. The only person you were really allowed to love was your girlfriend. It was just so great being allowed to feel that way, like a million locked doors opening at once. She was the only person I ever admitted to loving. Fucking tragic, eh? And, like, that just resonated so hard from, like, yeah, my experience being socialized, like, growing up, presenting as a boy, and, like, all these emotions that I had to repress and, like, feeling like you couldn't express affection or emotion elsewhere. So even if, like, we don't get confirmation that maybe Dane's gay, at least we can see, like, he does get over that, and he's able to physically comfort either his future self or just his companion of, I mean, they seem a little homeless in those panels, but I don't know, it just gives me a little hope for Dane as a turning out into a decent person.
Same. There's definitely hope there. He's definitely a product of his society, and he's been yanked out of that. So he can really go anywhere. He's just kind of got to fight himself at that point. And he does. I love where, like, kind of the Matrix thing, where all of the different storylines are kind of converging, and he's there in this, like, kind of alternate dimension fighting this demon, which is definitely kind of himself too. And I just love how he works that in, because I think that's a voice that isn't heard a lot. The person that was born into circumstances that makes them hate and makes them, like, kind of punch the world, and seeing him deal with that, and that also playing into the main story so well, is really cool.
And I do like how that confrontation, like, it's very reminiscent of Stephen King's It for me. And, like, how it's, you know, it's just referring back to what you knew as a kid, or, like, disarming the opponent and not giving into fear. Like, the way that book puts it is, like, you've got to slam your fists against the post and still insist you see the ghost. Just tying back to the little stuttering rhymes that one of the main characters has to repeat over and over to, like, get over their own limitations. And yeah, here, like, we just see one Dane treating this other demon character like, you're not shit, and cutting them down, just like, yeah, they're gonna swear at him, and it works pretty well. And just trusting their instinct of, like, okay, I'm just gonna pull whatever's in this shopping bag that old Tom left me and put that to use. And, like, internally, he knows what to do when he's trusting that he knows what to do. And, like, with very little outside help, he succeeds in defeating, like, an arch demon. And it makes all these moments of, like, this little rebellious asshole, like, kind of pay off. I'm like, okay, you know what? This kid, he's the real deal. Like, he's the most rebellious kid.
He is, yeah. And it reminds me a lot of Stephen King's Insomnia a lot, too. The Crimson King is very similar to these demons, and even the little realm that's in Insomnia, where he ends up, where the Crimson King is very similar to where Dane is as well.
Also, like, from Dane's past, one of the few things I noticed revisiting this, so we get the reveal that Dane's teacher, Mr. Malcolm, is actually, like, King Mob's mentor. Like, he's some kind of, like, Invisibles legend, and I guess they've been looking out after Dane, and, like, they have kind of this weird Division X that's, like, super secret government Invisibles related stuff, or dealing with the kinds of things the Invisibles interfere with. And I didn't notice the first time that all of that's built up through the book. Like, people are talking about, like, yeah, Division X got reactivated. And then we see that in the end, like, in a chapter that presumably takes place before the rest, like, finding out that the Myrmidians have bred some kind of Antichrist with Princess Di and some, like, demon Cho'Gath character.
And they're so good with that, too. The callbacks and the foreshadowing. Just like the way the first book ended, or the first volume, focusing on one security guard that randomly gets shot in the beginning, and then going at the very end, doing a full chapter on this one minuscule character's life, and then they get shot in that scene, and you're like, oh, that's that random guard that just got shot in the beginning of the book. And he does the same thing with Mr. Malcolm, and it made me so happy, because when I was reading the first volume, I was like, oh, I really like that teacher, and he was really sweet, and we need more teachers that really kind of focus on even the bad kids. And we need more people like that. And it just made me so happy. And I was like, I'll never see this character again, you know. And then in the next book, it turns out, like, he was one of the agents the whole time. And it made me so happy. It was such a good payoff. He is really good with payoffs.
And just the idea that, like, hey, your lamest teachers might have been the coolest frickin' person before they became a teacher.
Having been a teacher for a couple of months before, I was like, no, I very much appreciate any time that is done, because it is a tough job.
Now, one thing I did want to make sure we touch on here is that, like, there's definitely content in this volume that, like, it's edgier than what was there previously, and I could see it rubbing some modern readers the wrong way. but like, this is a subversive text. It's subversive media. So you can't go in expecting versive language. I mean, a lot of the terminology in Lord Fanny's backstory, like, doesn't really fit the current nomenclature. Boy's backstory gets an issue in this. Then I'm like, okay, it's pretty clear this probably wasn't written by a black writer, but like, still there's things to like about it. And like, there's still truths that are shown in there about like what it's like to grow up in poverty. And like, they do interesting things with that story. And the one that really stood out to me, like, there's a bunch of awesome scenes with like how they handle King Mob's escape and like how they're going about the torture, how it's like all mental based, and like anything they read is gonna seem real to them, or it's like what they're gonna see. And like, they've put some kind of Cthulhu virus into their blood system that's corrupting their immune system. And then the way they get around that is like, wait, we just have to strap down this rich bastard and take his blood, and then we'll have the immunity to this thing. And like, they just have a line of like, hope you don't have AIDS, asshole. I'm like, okay, that's a weird kind of thing you would only see written in the 90s by someone edgy, probably. But like, when it's queer characters stealing the blood of a rich elite asshole saying a line like that, it's like, this feels a little empowering, though.
It was a little empowering, yeah. Especially at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's better than Rent.
Yeah, I'll stand by that.
Yeah.
And I did want to point out, okay, this is some of the most common Invisibles trivia. Like, if anyone's ever talking about Chaos Magic or Grant Morrison or the Invisibles, these things come up. But, like, right before we recorded this episode, I pulled up the letters columns from these issues, and I'd really recommend anyone that reads this do that. There's a good Google Drive that has all of, I think it's like the Invisibles Inc., and that's all the letters columns. And those in themselves are a harrowing tale of what Grant Morrison was going through when writing this. Because, like, he'll talk about with his Chaos Magic, this was where he saw their writing, like, affecting their lives. Like, King Mob gets taken in, and they start showing him deformed versions of his face, making him feel like he's the Elephant Man. And then in real life, Grant was, like, taken into the hospital with a flesh-eating bacteria, putting a hole in his cheek. And then, like, they thought they were getting better. There's an issue or two where things seem to be turning around for them. And then next thing you know, Mark Millar, the writer of, like, Kick-Ass and Kingsman and Old Man Logan, Civil War, a bunch of things that I liked as a kid that I don't like now. Like, he stepped in to fill in for the letters column, and they're like, yeah, Grant Morrison's got a collapsed lung in the hospital, so they can't do this right now. We appreciate any cards and well wishes. And this happened, like, just 2-3 months after King Mob has a collapsed lung from the torture and, like, getting shot. And they just talk about, like, this felt terrifying to me. They started having delirious hallucinations from, like, the pain meds some quack doctor was giving them that were making the virus, or, like, making things worse and putting them in more pain. And, like, they started seeing hallucinations of, like, Jesus coming to them and saying, I am not the God of your fathers. And, like, they put that then directly into the Invisibles. And we see that in, like, what Dane experiences. So, like, so much of the text we see here is, in a sense, biographical to what Grant Morrison was experiencing. And not just on some psychedelic trip in the past that they wanted to share with the world, but, like, what it felt like to be getting tortured by a virus, whether or not that was being engineered by someone or just some dumbass doctor that didn't know how to properly diagnose what was going on. Like, Grant Morrison, by all accounts, should have died in that. But thankfully, by chance occurrence, like, some, like, doctor of celebrities, like Mick Jagger's doctor was there, and he showed up, diagnosed what it was, got him on better meds, and saved his life. And if it weren't for a chance happenstance that that celebrity doctor was passing through town, Grant would almost certainly be dead. So I understand why Grant feels like this magical connection to the book and its connection to their life and how the works, like, influence the direction of his life as, like, a hyper sigil. Because if that happened to me, I would 100% believe that my writing is magic and that this is happening. And, like, who am I to say that this isn't? Or, like, that Grant's writing didn't somehow mentally influence things to, like, help things get better. But this is why I say the back matter is 100% worth looking up and finding online, because it's not in the graphic novel, but I had just as much fun reading these letters columns as I did reading the comic today.
And yeah, like, yeah, writing is magic. That's how I've always, you know, I've been many phases in my life, and I've definitely had my crystal phase and my, you know, all my later witchiness or whatever. But when I was younger, it was writing. It was things like Terminator 2 and stuff like that made me feel things so intensely and really did connect me to reality more. And to me, creation is magic. Whether it be putting together a computer, which is very much like a human mind, or an AI or something, or writing a book. I mean, look at all the power that Homer's stuff had. Like, wow, you can't get more powerful magic than that. I mean, everything is based on it. The human experience is like the Odyssey.
Even if there's like a degree of separation in it, like when people see a character that they want to aspire to be like, especially in spaces like ours where you don't know trans people like this, queer people like this exist until you see them in media, and then you have a goal in mind and you try to become more like them, like that's bringing that character to life. That even like you, if you don't want to call it magic, fine, but that is an act of creation that's inspiring real world creation. That's fictitious creation that then inspires real life. And I think that in itself is magic of like, if you can create something that then influences a world outside of the fiction you've made, that's magic.
Mm-hmm. It's very culture bound too, because we have very much the Joseph Campbell Homeric journey. Whereas when you read manga and watch movies from other places like Japan or China or Korea or, you know, India or wherever, they have different storytelling, and it's really cool. I mean, to me, again, that is magic. And they all have they're all very similar, but they have different quirks, which is really cool. And I love delving into the cultural differences and how much is the same, but what is different as well.
And that was something I noticed, like when we make parallels to the Matrix here, this volume, it gets really clear because the whole rescuing of King Mob feels very similar to the second half of the Matrix of like rescuing Morpheus and like Neo discovering his powers in the process. Meanwhile, Dane discovers like their magic healing powers in the process. But with the Invisibles, there's so many like added weird elements and like multiple layers of storytelling and just like things I'd never seen before that I don't read this and be like, oh yeah, this is the Joseph Campbell hero's journey, like beat for beat. Maybe it's a little more clear with Dane getting trained by like an old homeless wizard in the first volume, but like this doesn't feel quite the same. Whereas with the Matrix, like I love the Matrix, but yeah, I mean, it's Star Wars with computer reality instead. Like we see those beats much more clearly there, and it's like not nearly as maybe creative, or it's not doing as much to like separate itself from a traditional retelling of the hero's journey as Invisibles does.
The Matrix is like a pepperoni pizza, and the Invisibles is one of those weird ass pizzas that's like a Mexican barbecue pizza or whatever you want to call it, with like tortilla chips and like guac and like all sorts of stuff on it. Yeah, technically the pizza's in there, but it's got a lot of other stuff on it too, and it's really yummy, and you've never tasted anything like it.
I'm really looking forward to seeing where the series goes from here. Like, from all accounts I've heard, I know King Mob has just an easier time of things going forward. Like, Grant Morrison was too scared to put him through anything else. And, like, we see more pleasant things in the next chapter. Like, you hear he gets rich, he gets a girlfriend, and Grant started dating girls that looked like his girlfriend in real life. And I know they're going to be in America, so, like, hey, step closer to our back door. And I'm really excited to see where this goes now that, like, things can get happier, Dane's a proper invisible, and, like, we can actually explore this world. It's not just the same, like, incorporating Dane, then losing Dane, and then finding him again, and then we're broken apart in rescue mission. Like, I want to see the Invisibles together in force doing what Invisibles do, whatever that looks like.
Same. I definitely want to see more Robin, because I feel like she is kind of the one that I just don't really know anything about Robin still, and I'm really intrigued. And And I really want to see where Dane's story goes, mm-hmm. too. I still feel like we are at the very beginning of Dane's story. And yeah, I still really want to see where that goes. I'm very excited for the third one.
Now, did you have a favorite issue from this volume?
I would say probably the first one, Fanny's story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of, you know, some people might have a problem with it because in the first one, you see her as Fanny. You see her with her wig and her dress and very much like a trans woman. Whereas in this one, wow, you see all of Fanny. You see her beginning. You see just the persona stripped naked to her very bare self. But Fanny is still there. And I kind of like that because, like, even though through the majority of this volume, if you opened it up and was just skimming it, you wouldn't even know you saw Fanny because she doesn't have her wig on. She doesn't, you know, she's in prison. She doesn't have her wig on. She doesn't, you know, her makeup's all kind of smeared off. And she does look what we would consider masculine. She's got the shorter hair, but it's still Fanny. And yeah. As, you know, as I get older, as I am farther along in my transition, you know, and when I first transitioned, it was very important to me to always be presenting. But I think it's a huge, giant moment when you realize you're you, no matter what. So to see Fanny in so many different ways, but still being herself and still being true to herself, actually really meant a lot to me. And you just find out so much about Fanny that you would have never have even guessed. And wow, her journey is amazing. And little Fanny is adorable.
Yeah, I really do love that they strip her down to like the bare components and still she's like doing witchcraft stuff, taunting mm-hmm. guards and like being badass. And like never for a minute does King Mob see her as anything but Lord Fanny.
And
yeah, trans icon right there. Like she alone makes this comic worth reading.
Yes.
Personally, for a favorite, I think I've got to go with issue 23. And that's the one that starts with Dane looking in the future, looking at maybe his future self. Just because, like, I really resonated with so much of Dane's experience through this. And, like, that moment specifically of just finding a person that, like, whether or not that's future Dane, like, they're seeing themselves in because this person is engaged with this otherworldly, unbelievable story. And, like, this is what I felt coming out of that first ego death experience before I was able to put it to, like, a narrative podcast. Once in a great while, I would find someone who'd be like, I know what you're talking about. Or like, I've seen something like this. Or like, they would get it. They'd say things back to me. Or like, they'd help me dig deeper into it. And like, when I'd have that moment, I would see myself in them. Like an I am you moment. But like, an I am you is in the universe. Or seeing yourself in other people. And I just really resonated with that. Like, someone is finally engaging with Dane's story. They're telling Dane can tell everything, and they even get to the very personal core of, like, even if none of this is real, what were their inner demons they were facing of, like, this experience with their first girlfriend, all these things of self-doubt, and then realizing that, like, you're everyone, or everyone is, like, moving forward into this, like, kind of super being, just, like, seeing this weird nonlinear time thing of, like, past and future selves coming in and out ahead and behind you, and finding a way to put that into words in a way that's like bringing some level of comfort and joy to another person. Because like the world is ending, presumably. And like both these characters are at peace. And it just seems like such a touching, loving moment that someone telling their story is bringing two people together and bringing them peace while the world is literally about to end. So they're not panicking about it. And like, I think as a storyteller, that's really all I can aspire to do is tell people otherworldly stories, share wild experiences, and hopefully bring people some kind of comfort and self-recognition in the telling of those stories.
It really hits that part of youth when you realize you're on your own. Like his mom gets out of the picture. Like his
friend sells him out.
There's the flashbacks of the girlfriend that leaves him for like the cooler older guy. And he really like realizes like, yeah, it's just him, you know, it's just you. And then you can stop acting a little bit when you realize it's just you. And I really like seeing that with his character. And one more thing, I wouldn't say it was my favorite chapter. That was definitely the first one with Fanny and her backstory, because I had just been wanting that so bad. And it really paid off. But I was most surprised by the boy chapter, which is just one of the random kind of like disconnected story, but still, you know, creates that character of boy and adds to their backstory a little bit. I think it's in Chicago, and being Grant Morrison, I was honestly pretty ready to be offended and just like, because race is definitely a big part of this issue. And I think I even initially skipped it, and then I kind of went back to it, and I was like, oh wow, that was actually really poignant and kind of ahead of its time of pointing out like gentrification, and especially someplace like Chicago. I grew up in Atlanta. I saw it happen there. So to see someone that sometimes makes, I'm not going to lie, they make me cringe a little bit sometimes, to see them tackle that and do a really good job at the time that they did is really awesome. And then I did really like the Dane chapters too. And again, when Mr. Malcolm popped up, and turns out he's one of them. Oh, that was so cool.
But, Ari, any final thoughts from you before we wrap up?
I think I just gave them before you even asked me. So, I'm good.
Well, thank you, Ari, for joining me once again on this deep dive into the Invisibles. And also, thank you for sharing so much about your own personal experience and what about this book resonates with you, and for giving us some context of what it was like a generation before mine growing up and seeing media like this or media outside of this. And I feel like that really does still add to my appreciation of the book, and it's why I'd like to keep having you on these episodes.
Aw, thank you.
But if the listeners at home have requests or recommendations for comics or creators you'd like us to cover in the future, you can send them our way on social media. You can find us on the Transcending Comics Instagram and Facebook page, on Twitter is at Transcend Comics, or email us at transcendingcomics@gmail.com. We'd like to thank you again for giving our podcast a chance, and give a special shout out to Ray Day Parade for designing our logo and cover photos. Our intro and outro music this week is A Little Soul and You've Been Starring by Carlson. You can check out more of their music on carlson.com. Join us again next time as we continue transcending boundaries and exploring the colorful world of trans, non-binary, and genderqueer representation in comic books of all kinds. As the curtains fall on this episode of Transcending Comics, remember that comics have the power to inspire change in countless worlds, including our own. Keep reading, keep writing, and keep transcending.